Welcome to Targeted, True Crime, Domestic Violence. We tell stories of those who were targeted by domestic abuse and investigate cases of family violence, using academic research to interpret the events. As a college professor, I think we need to stop making family violence a secret. It's time to tell our stories, use our experiences to help, heal, and provoke change. Targeted discusses sensitive information about abuse. Details may be graphic, and listener discretion is advised. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. Merry Christmas! The holidays are a time of joy for some, but a source of pain for others. Domestic violence does not take a holiday. Be extra sweet and patient with those around you, because we do not know what challenges they face at home. For those of you whom Christmas is not a celebration this year, I understand. But there is a new year about to dawn, and it brings limitless possibilities and hope for the future. More than anything else, I pray for peace for each of you. Merry Christmas, my friends. Merry Christmas. Last week, we heard about Marie's childhood and traced the legacy of abuse from Marie's grandfather, which affected her mother's way of understanding and processing abuse and allowed her mom to let abuse continue in her children's lives, to Marie's stepfather's abuse of her. Today, we are going to shift to Marie's adult life. Always remember, though, the legacy of abuse that overshadows Marie. If you haven't already listened to part one of Marie's story, I recommend going back and hearing that one first to better understand the context of Marie's story. As we often do, we're using pseudonyms for safety and privacy reasons. We ended last week with this thought from our interview.
I know men and women both abuse their partners, but my experience has been the men. And so that desensitized me to where whenever I went into my marriage, it didn't seem like a big deal that I was being abused.
We'll start with exploring Marie's emotions and responses as a teenager and young adult. The abuse she experienced when younger now impacts her relationships.
Immediately, just dating, I accept problems that I shouldn't accept because I already had this shame and this worthlessness feeling from all the shame that had been put on me as a child. So I've just started into relationships feeling worthless and shameful about myself. And so I didn't have a voice when I should have in relationships. And also being desensitized to the domestic violence. When I was young, I was a fighter. I was strong and I could take it and I could dish it out as well as I could take it. Somebody would hit me, then the fight was on, you know? I wasn't one that backed down. It was like I never had control of everything that happened in my past. And now I have control of the situation. It's like do or die time. Like if you attack me, you're going to get what you got coming to you. And that sounds really bad, but at the same time, I mean, what are women supposed to do when someone hits you? Like, are you just supposed to lay down and cry? I guess some women do that, but I'm not that kind of woman. I started out, even my teenage boyfriends, we were physically confrontational with each other. I ended up getting in a serious relationship and having a child with a man who, like I said, he was super sweet if he wasn't drinking. And at least I had that warning sign. If I walked in and he was drunk, I could get my baby and leave and go stay somewhere else that night until he could lose the buzz or whatever. But he was a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. If he was drunk, he was angry and violent. If he wasn't, he was the sweetest guy you'll ever know, just very friendly. I took my child and went into a shelter myself. Whenever my child was about a year old. From then on, it was a custody battle where he kept trying to take him away from me. I started going through a domestic violence situation with my new marriage. And then my mother teamed up with my first child's father in trying to help him take my son from me. And I confronted her and I said, Mom, do you think that I can't be a good mom because you weren't, like, you didn't show me how to be a good mom, and that makes where I can't be a good mom now? Is that what this attack is about? And she said, yes. She said, I don't see how you could be a good mother with everything that you've been through. Throughout my therapy, I've just learned to forgive my mom because I know what domestic violence is like. It starts out slow. It starts out, you don't know what's happening. And then you start getting a little uncomfortable. And then it gets worse and worse and worse and worse until you feel like you might as well be dead. And you don't see a way out.
Marie's mother's judgment had been skewed by her own experience of abuse, and perhaps she thought she was protecting her grandson. But Marie doesn't think that her mom fully understood the abusiveness of husband number one. Marie called him a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. This is one of the most recurrent themes I've found in all of my interviews with survivors of domestic violence. There are often two sides to the perpetrator. And survivors honestly, truly love the one side, the positive side of the abuser. Survivors talk about the good part of the abuser's personality as being the quote-unquote real person. The abusive side is de-emphasized, and the hope is that the negative can be managed away, or perhaps even that the abuser will learn to control it and it will cease to be a problem. Since the abuser has these two sides of the personality, often friends and family are only exposed to the positive side. So they honestly believe that the abuser is a good, kind person. How would they know otherwise? They've only experienced the good side of the abuser, and the survivor often hides the abuse, so the friends and family don't have the information to change their high opinion. I don't bring this up to blame any survivors for protecting the abuser by hiding the abuse, but simply to point out that this is what many of us do. I spent somewhere around 15 years protecting my husband, thinking that I can't let anyone know about these incidents or they'll think something negative about my husband. And I didn't want people to think badly of him. The difference between me and Marie is that when I finally did talk about it after hiding for so many years, while it came like a bombshell exploding into my family, they believed me and wanted to do anything and everything to help me and my kids move forward. Marie didn't have that. Eventually, her mother's interference seems to have helped her cause Marie to lose custody of her son. But it didn't happen right away. We're going to pause for a moment to hear a word from our sponsors. I'm thankful for them because their support makes the podcast possible. Marie moved forward after she divorced her husband, and a new part of her life began.
I was in a very desperate situation because I was working two jobs and going to school for nursing. I was barely getting by, and in order to spend time with my son, he slept in my bed with me because that was the only time I had to spend with him. So, you know, I would lay there with my little one-year-old, my two-year-old, three-year-old, and we would spend that time together, just that one little hour before we went to sleep. And then up in the morning, and he's back to daycare, and I'm back to work and school, like a relentless cycle. And when I had children, I did not leave my children with my family. I was not going to expose my children to that. I didn't trust my mother's judgment, and I surely wasn't going to leave my children with either of my fathers. And so I was doing all this with no help from my family. It was me and daycare and work and school, and that was it. That's all I had. I had friends that would help me along the way a little, friends that I met completely separate of my little social network of my family. And so it's funny, if you keep those crazy abusive people out of your life, you see a whole lot more of loving, supportive people that are more willing to be there in your life. And you get to be that person for them too. I barely had any time, so I met someone at work because I had no social life, I had no dating life. There was not even dating apps or Facebook. I didn't have time to for any of that. I actually, when I met my now ex-husband, I was not even looking for anyone to date at work. I was like, I'm not hearing it. But yeah, one of our friends pitted us kind of together. He went and he said, hey, this girl over there wants your number. And then he went over there and told me, hey, this guy over there wants your number, and like switched our numbers for us. I mean, neither one of us was looking to date.
Although Marie wasn't looking for a relationship, one developed. She had her eyes open, though, and wanted to set up a few boundaries early on. Let's hear her discuss the early part of their dating life.
Our first date, he was super nice. He's Hispanic, and I speak fluent Spanish. At the end of our date, he walked me to my car. In the parking lot, he stripped down to his underwear and climbed on top of me and continued to shove his tongue down my throat. And I was like, whoa, get back, first off. Like, this is not being reciprocated here. I know that this is all positive energy for you or whatever, but this is too aggressive for me. Like, you're not the kind of person that I want to date. And we didn't date again for 3 to 6 months after that happened. You know, we're still working together. Now all the girls know he's like the bachelor who's willing to date, and they're kind of all after him. He's like a professional bodybuilder, really good looking guy. All these girls are kind of flocking around him, and he's blowing them all off, and he's still got his eye on me. And I'm like, okay, maybe he's a nice guy. He comes to me and he says, look, I want to apologize to you. I'm not like that. I don't sleep around. I wasn't trying to do anything like that. I'm a bodybuilder and I stripped down to show you my work. You know, he's like, for me to stand on a spinning pedestal in a full room is nothing. Like, this is just something that I'm just real comfortable with in my body and showing my body. And he said, and I don't treat women that way. I love my mom. I'm a good little Catholic boy. You know, I'm sorry that I give that misconception that I was going to be overly aggressive with you. He's like, can we just give it another try? And so he was very gentle and very kind with me when we started dating again. At this time, between my first child's father and meeting him, I waited 2 years, as my therapist recommended, so that I could overcome the domestic violence abuse pattern and learn to live outside of abuse.
With an appropriate amount of time for Marie to work through the healing from the first violent marriage, and with boundaries established, this relationship became serious. And just like that, everything changed.
Yet, as soon as I got pregnant with our first child, he became extremely violent towards me. He would tear up my cars. He would jump out of the car. He would drive recklessly with me in the car. A lot was centered around the car. Car is like a death trap when you're in an abusive situation. So I'm still going to therapy, and I'm dealing with how to correct him. And my therapist is like, Angie, you're seeing red flags. Like, cut him loose. And I'm like, but I'm pregnant, and I was barely making it taking care of this one child. Now I'm supposed to be taking care of an infant, like diapers and formula and a toddler at the same time and going to school and working 2 jobs. Like, I'm tired. I need his help to take care of this child. And he was not violent towards me. No signs of physical violence until after I got pregnant with his child. About 16, maybe 18 weeks pregnant, I was hit by a drunk driver and lost the child. So now, not only have I lost the child, but I've lost my vehicle. And so still struggling at that point. Now, how am I getting back and forth to work? How am I getting to school? Another thing happened during that time. His apartment burned to the ground. He ended up sleeping on my couch. So we're basically pitted together. We're kind of both dependent on each other. So when I lost the child, I told him, now get out of my house. Like, I didn't realize that when I was stuck with a child by you that you were going to start being abusive to me. I want you to leave. He started crying. I mean, tears rolling down his face, crying. I just lost my baby. That was my first and only baby. And now, you worthless bitch, you're just going to throw me out on the street with nowhere to go when my baby just died. And I'm like, you're not the only one that went through this. My baby just died too. I start feeling the guilt, shame, worthlessness, and I let him stay. You know, within just a couple of months, I was already pregnant again and having another baby. And then he'd been nice until I got pregnant again. And then when I was pregnant, I mean, just holy terror rained down again.
Pregnancy may be a particularly dangerous time for a woman. I've recently researched this topic again, something we discussed during season 2 with Tracy Thurman's case. The United States Department of Justice estimates that about 10% of pregnant women experience intimate partner violence, although some studies report a higher percentage, such as an article by Mary Ann Curry in the Journal of Obstetric, Gynecologic, and Neonatal Nursing. There's an interesting discussion of the relationship between pregnancy and abuse in Beth Bailey's 2010 research in the International Journal of Women's Health. Evidently, some of the research is mixed about the prevalence of abuse with pregnancy, largely because there are such different methods for collecting evidence. So it's hard to get exact numbers about this. But at the most conservative, we can say about 10% of pregnant women experience abuse. A number of the studies over the years argue for pregnancy being a specific risk for abuse. But of course, each perpetrator has their own set of skewed reasons. It's a common theme that's come up in a lot of interviews that I've personally conducted, and it certainly seems that Marie's abuser had this particular trigger. I asked Marie about the time between the pregnancies.
When he would cry like that, I would literally feel that he was genuinely sorrowful for what he did and wanted to find a new way and be the right kind of guy. Like, I really thought that he was heartbroken about the loss of his child and that he would turn around and be this good guy.
So Marie stayed with him. I always think it is poignant when a target stays with someone who abused them, but not because I blame the survivors. It's so sad because a survivor often has that vision of who the abuser could be, should be. And I think if only the abusers could catch that vision, if only they would be the people their loved ones see. Regardless, Marie's partner had other problems as well related to substance abuse. Research establishes a strong correlation between substance abuse and domestic violence. A study in Addictive Behaviors Journal establishes that abusers in their study were 5 times more likely to abuse substances. Another study published in the academic journal Genetic, Social, and General Psychology Monographs showed that abusers were significantly more likely to be substance abusers and have a more serious problem with substance abuse. It is likely that this played a role in Marie's husband's abuse. As she is about to discuss, steroid abuse was a part of his life.
Another thing that weighed in on my relationship with him is that he had been on steroids for 15 years. Like I said, he was a competitive bodybuilder. Not only steroids, but like liver cleansers, colon cleansers, insulin, thyroid medicine. I mean, everything that you have to do to be lean and muscular, he was on it. And I feel like he's permanently brain damaged from all that, and especially from the steroids. When he gets mad, I mean, all of his veins pop, his eyes pop out of his head, he turns solid red, just like not even the same guy anymore. So basically what happened is he wasn't horribly, horrendously violent towards me. He would grab me, restrain me, lock me into a closet, but he wouldn't like beat me relentlessly. I mean, I have all my teeth. You know, it wasn't like what I went through with my mom. And here it is, I'm justifying that I'm making a better way for myself and my children than my mother made for me. And she did the same thing. She was making a better way than her mother and father made for her. It just dominoed into now I'm the one going through this domestic violence situation and I'm just trying to maintain. Like, he would hit me and tell me, "You're not going with me. I'm going out with my buddies." You know, I would go down and I would kick the headlights out of his car. I mean, I was still the fighter. to me, I justified it. I'm not letting him get away with abusing me because I'm fighting back. But really, now that I look back at it, I let him be abusive to me, not because I didn't fight him back, but because I let it keep happening. And in my mind, I was big and bad and tough because, boy, when he messed with me, I messed with him right back. And so I taught him a lesson and I stood up for myself and I didn't let domestic violence happen in my house. Yet it was domestic violence because I was fighting him saying, hey, you're not going to be abusive to me. Don't talk to me like that. Don't act like that. Don't put your hands on me. Don't even think about hitting me in the mouth. You know, sometimes you're being beaten and you fight back because you're not just going to lay down and die. Even women who are beaten to death, we're not just going to lay down and let you beat us to death. We are going to fight. And that doesn't make us not the victim here. We're the victim because we had a peaceful, hopeful happiness in our hearts and we wanted love and family and security and safety. When you attacked us and we fought back, we're still the victim. And that's something that the courts couldn't see in family law, and it caused me a lot of problems in my divorce. I mean, when I went through domestic violence with him, for example, when I was in divorce court, Child Protective Services had came out to my house. And at this time, I'm kind of defending him when other people are attacking, because I don't want my first child's father to take him. So with my two children that are now experiencing domestic violence because of their father, I had like the go bag thing in my car. I had the safety plan. Like I had someone to call to rent me a motel room, and I had a bag packed with an outfit or two for me and all my kids in the trunk of my car at all times. And so when he would get angry or violent, I would scoop up my kids and we would take off. And then we'd come back after he'd cooled down, whether it be 2 to 3 days, a week later, however long it was, I would just come back.
It was around this time that Marie had to deal more with social services. I know most of us hoped that this would bring help to Marie, but it didn't.
Instead of fighting back, I started to run because Child Protective Services came out and was asking questions and opened cases against my family about the domestic violence that was happening with my two younger children in the home. All three of my children were in the home. The thing is, the first child's father was calling Child Protective Services in defense of his child and trying to take his child from me, even though, keep in mind, he was physically violent towards me and his son himself. Yet he's going to act like he wasn't. Even with police reports and CPS reports and everything, he actually was charged with endangerment of a child to his own child before I left. And so when the CPS would come out, start asking questions to me about the domestic violence, and they were asking about it happening, I would try to minimize what was happening to the authorities because I didn't want my first child to be put in harm's way by being taken from me and put with his father. CPS literally told me, they said, if you don't want us involved in your life like this, stop calling the police. Because when he would physically attack me, I would call the police for help. I would say, help, get out here. My husband's gone crazy. You know, whatever has happened in that event. And so the police would come out. They would make him leave. I would have to tell the story without telling the whole story, because if I told the whole story, then I would lose my first child. And so finally, I stopped calling the police and things got worse. He got more aggressive and more physically violent. He put a knife to my throat. He put a gun to my head while I was asleep. He pulled a gun on me. He pulled a gun on me one time and I snatched the gun from his hand and threw it on the floor and then laid down on top of it while he physically beat me. Because I didn't want him to get access to the gun, I took him beating me. And when I say beating me, you know, it's not like I lost my teeth. And here I go minimizing again. I mean, it wasn't like that kind of beating. It was like scrapes and bruises from him grabbing me and slamming me around. And, you know, keep in mind, he was a professional bodybuilder, but I was a bodybuilder too. But I was more like women's physique. I was like 5'10 and 155 pounds. Meantime, he's bench pressing everything the weight bar will hold. And he would pick me up and throw me across the room. I mean, literally throw me. So that's kind of the abuse that I was going through. The final straw came when he beat himself in the head with a metal crutch. And he was beating himself in the head while crying, "Please don't call the police because I don't want you to go to jail for beating me like this." He's begging me not to call the police because he doesn't want me to go to jail while he beats himself unconscious. And he beat himself like that while crying until he passed out on the floor with me and my kids crying and begging him to stop.
As Marie said, that was the final time her husband abused her physically. I wish that we could end Marie's story here with a positive note about how she and the children live together apart from her abusive ex-husband. Unfortunately, I cannot. There's more. Next week on Targeted.
My divorce was set to be final, but the day before the judge was to sign the final orders, he robbed me of $350,000 that I had stashed away in my house, drained all of our accounts, took my children, and tried to shoot me in the head. I ran for my life, and I've yet to see my children again.
Thanks so much for joining us at Targeted Podcast, True Crime, Domestic Violence. If you're interested in my sources or research, I include a bibliography on my website, www.targetedpodcast.com. If you want to support the show, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and writing a sentence or two about what you like. It helps other listeners to find us. If you have constructive criticism, I would like to hear it, but I'd appreciate an email about it. You can reach me at targetedpodcast@gmail.com. Targeted has a Facebook page and a Twitter account. Links to those will be in the show notes. We also have a Patreon account, which was recently revised so that you can gain early access to ad-free episodes for $1 each. If you want early access to all of the episodes in a month, it will be $4 most months, and there would be no expense for months when we do not have new episodes. Please stay tuned for the promos at the end of the podcast and check them out if they sound interesting. I'll include links to them in my show notes. As we end, let me emphasize that if you or someone you know is targeted by abuse, you are not alone. I've included some contact information in the show notes and on the website about a number of different organizations who can help. Leaving an abusive relationship can be one of the most dangerous times for a target, and I strongly encourage you to reach out for support. It may be the hardest thing you ever do, but it will be worth it. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. Peace, my friends. Peace. I'm going to be playing a promo for Invisible Choir, which is a podcast by Michael Ojibwe. This is a fairly new podcast, but it's a new favorite for lots of people. One of the things I love about this particular podcast is that it focuses on underrepresented populations. Stories that we do not hear about often enough.
I'm Michael Ojibwe, host of Invisible Choir, a true crime podcast that explores the most heinous murders through investigative storytelling and primary source audio. We'll take you on an unforgettable emotional journey to the crime scenes themselves as we explore the individual and community impact behind some truly horrendous and often preventable crimes.
They slammed the kid on the ground and stabbing their baby out here in the middle of the
They're stabbing their baby?
Yes, he's dead on the ground outside. And they're yelling.
With 911 calls and actual recordings.
I shot my wife in the temple of her head and my children. And I put her in the freezer. I checked on her at night and I did.
These are the stories of the victims of under-investigated crimes, their voices crying out in unison from beyond the grave, for they are the Invisible Choir. Download Invisible Choir today on Himalaya or wherever you listen to podcasts.